you for joining us on today's episode of the Wharton FinTech Podcast. I'm your host, Wesley Astor. Today, we're joined by Jonathan Whittle, the co-founder and managing partner at Quona, a global venture capital firm investing in fintechs and emerging markets, where he leads the firm's Latin America investment strategy. Jonathan is a seasoned investor and entrepreneur with over 25 years of experience in Latin America. Before co-founding Quona, he was co-founder and CEO of Acesso, a leading prepaid financial service provider for the unbanked population in Brazil. Prior to Acesso, Jonathan managed Darby Technology Ventures, a pioneering VC fund for Latin America. He joined Darby after a decade of experience as part of the founding team of leading telecommunications and data services companies in Latin America, including Givio, which was acquired by UOL, and OptiGlobe, which is now Tivit. Jonathan, it's an honor to have you with us on the podcast.
Thanks, Wesley. It's a real pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So I know I just gave a brief overview of your background, but I'd love if we could begin by you telling the audience about your career journey and your path to founding Quona with Monica and Ganesh.
Sure. So let me start from the beginning. And as you noted, I have been in business in Latin America for 25 years. So it's many decades of experience. I'm probably probably one of the older people you've had on your podcast focused on LATAM. I was born in the U.S., but raised in Central America and Spain, and my entire career has been focused on Latin America. As you know, I started out with a few venture-backed companies in the telecom space. These were U.S.-based companies, but focused on Latin America that raised a lot of capital during the original internet bubble in the 90s. Actually ended up moving to Argentina with the second of those two companies, Givio, which was eventually acquired by UOL. Lived there for 7 years. Two of my kids were born in Argentina. The telecom internet bubble burst. Argentina melted down at the same time, as did Brazil. And the last of the companies basically, hit a wall. It was a lot of learnings there. We raised $330 million in equity in a period of about 15 months. And then the bottom fell out of the market. We were building large scale data centers across Latin America, Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, Rio. The market kind of fell out on us and it was time to move back to the U.S. I joined a private equity firm, Darby, to manage a venture capital fund focused on early stage investments across Latin America. And this was at a time when nobody was investing in the region. So it's very, very pioneering in that regard. This is the early 2000s. It was a good decade or so before the emergence of the leading venture capital firms in the region. Through those investments, I actually started investing in what now we would call fintech, the companies that were providing financial services by leveraging technology across Latin America, some successful investments in that space that actually got me exposed to what was happening in prepaid. So prepaid at the time in the U.S. Had a few players like Green Dot, Netspend, and others that were basically providing banking services to the unbanked in Latin America through reloadable prepaid card services. I decided to leave Darby and start a company in that space in Brazil. Think of it as a precursor to challenger banking. Secured the first non-bank issuing license from MasterCard, built out a distribution network, distributing cards through some of the largest supermarket chains and the like in Brazil. But again, very focused on this underbanked segment. Was CEO of that company for 3 years and then really wanted to get back on the investment side. And that's when I was introduced to my co-founder, Monica, and the team at Acción, which is a microfinance firm that's been in the business for about 60 years. It's a nonprofit, but is always invested in microfinance institutions, really bringing market discipline to those microfinance institutions. But had done quite well as an investor and was looking to have an impact on financial inclusion beyond what microfinance could do, and began experimenting with some investments in fintech. And then decided to sponsor and being an anchor investor, what became Quona, which is a fund focused on leveraging financial technology to expand financial inclusion across emerging markets. So I was introduced to Monica. I thought it was an amazing fit. Loved the organization at Acción, their commitment to helping us get off the ground. So I joined forces with Monica in January of 2014. We began fundraising a little later that year. And then our third co-founder, Ganesh, who focuses on our Asia strategy, joined in August. So we've been together August of 2014. So it's now been 10 years of us working together. We can talk a bit more about the evolution of Quona, but that was the genesis of all of this.
One thing I think is really interesting about your background is that you've been on both sides of the table in the sense that you've been both a founder and an investor. I'd love to hear more about how you think this influences your current role and if you feel that your experience on both sides of the table has given you an edge or helped you to become a better investor.
Yeah, I hope it does, right? I've been in the shoes of the entrepreneur. I know how tough it is and how rewarding it can be. And I also know that the... you know, in order to be a successful entrepreneur, you really need an all-in approach. And I think I can appreciate what that journey is and what the highs, what the lows are, and what the challenges are. At the same time, as an investor, I think you have to be very objective and have the ability to be able to make assessments about where to invest, where to continue investing, where to pull back, and have that broad portfolio perspective that you don't want your entrepreneurs to have. But it's the combination of that portfolio objective view that you have as an investor combined with having been in the shoes of the entrepreneur, being able to identify those entrepreneurs that you really think have what it takes to build something amazing, while again, being able to, as an investor, recognize when things are working out, when they're not, when to lean in, when not. And having been in those shoes, there's a bit of humility. There's a lot that I recognize I don't know. I think the more you've been in those shoes, the more you recognize how difficult it is. And I believe, you know, entrepreneurs pick up on and appreciate. But yes, I do think that combination of having been an entrepreneur and an investor, it's served me well. I think there are a lot of investors that are actually very effective that don't have operational experience. But in my case, I think it's a unique perspective that brings unique value.
That makes a lot of sense. So I'd like to move forward to Quona today. Could you give us an overview of Quona today and how the firm has evolved since it was founded in 2014?
Sure. So when we started the firm, we had a few strong convictions. One, that technology was really revolutionizing the way that products could be developed and delivered to underserved consumers and small businesses across emerging markets. You had smartphone penetration, you had internet penetration, regulatory changes, changes that were happening on the back end, cloud computing and other technologies allowing for much easier, cheaper, faster development of applications that we could see was beginning to create significant tailwinds for the kind of innovation that could change markets where there was a significant underpenetration of financial services. Financial services are very expensive, and you had the large banks concentrating most of banking assets with extraordinarily high profitability, but with little expansion of those services to the masses. So that was one conviction. Two, we saw that there was a growing interest from investors in platforms that could deliver both top-tier financial return and measurable and authentic social impact. And it was our conviction that that capital was only going to be unlocked if we could build a platform that delivered both, that brought best practices to investment decisions and building a portfolio to deliver top tier financial return, but that it was also built with a focus on developing best practices, because best practices are still, I would say, in development, to focus on investments that are delivering measurable social impact and expanding access to financial services for these underserved segments of the population across emerging markets. So with that conviction, we launched the firm began fundraising in 2014. We raised our first fund in 2015, our second fund in 2018, third fund in 2021. So we now have about a little under $800 million in AUM. And our focus has remained actually quite consistent. We're focused on investments at the early stage in emerging markets, South, Southeast Asia, Latin America, Africa, and we're beginning to look at some things in the Middle East as well, with a platform that is truly global, a team that is deeply embedded in the markets that we invest in, but that's investing out of a single fund with a single strategy, making investment decisions together, and leveraging the perspective and experience that we have across these various markets to inform our investment decisions and bring a unique and differentiated value to our portfolio companies. Our organization has evolved as we've grown. We've expanded from an initial partnership of four. Now we have seven investment partners, plus an operating a partner. Obviously, our team has grown. We've been able to expand both the investment team and also our portfolio support teams. But the thesis has remained consistent, and what we've seen is indeed that technology has had a massive impact in the way that financial services are provided to these various markets. And I think what's been very rewarding is to then see regulators really embracing this idea that financial technology can have a positive impact on lowering costs, expanding access, breaking hegemony of the banks. And so there's been an evolution of the types of opportunities we've been able to invest in, the types of opportunities that we see evolving through a combination of regulators becoming increasingly favorable towards creating space for new entrants and digitizing the financial services space in general. And as financial technology has taken root, you have more and more infrastructure, more and more of the foundations upon which new players are able to innovate that early players perhaps had to build from scratch. So certainly there's been an evolution of the types of opportunities that we've invested in. But that initial thesis of Hoena has remained very much in place and has been solidified, and our conviction has only been strengthened over the last decade that we've been doing business together.
There's so many elements of what you shared that I love to dive into, from the regulatory aspect to Hoena's global footprint. To start, I'd love to talk about the focus on financial inclusion. Hoena recently completed its second successful impact verification process with Bluemark, which is a leading independent impact verification provider, scoring in the top of Bluemark's benchmarks. And more importantly, Hoena has made significant strides in financial inclusion, with investments touching over 144 million lives, 79% of whom were previously underserved. Could you tell us a little bit more about how this impacts your investment decisions and perhaps what criterion or metrics you look at when measuring impact?
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, we seek to make investments in companies that are going to have impact at scale and deliver financial returns at scale. So for us, it's very much a dual filter, where we are bringing, again, best practices in making investment decisions in backing entrepreneurs and theses that we believe have the potential to achieve massive scale and deliver many multiples of our investment. But we're also looking to invest in companies that are expanding access to financial services for these underserved segments. The framework that we evaluate companies by and then measure their performance against has three key pillars. One is access, and that's pretty straightforward, right? Is this company expanding access to financial services for these underserved segments across these emerging markets? Second is quality. Is this company bringing quality services that are actually helping small businesses, helping families to prosper, to build better lives, to reduce the uncertainties of life? Are these services that really are going to be helping and not harming? And then third is the markets pillar. Are these companies helping to develop markets, and are these an impact that they can have even beyond their own narrow focus on a particular market segment or the narrow focus of whether they're successful as a business? We do an assessment of our companies across multiple vectors, financial, operational, team, et cetera, as would any other venture firm. But then we also evaluate our companies around this impact framework and develop an impact thesis and discuss that and debate that as a partnership and as we make investment decisions. And then we monitor and track the impact that our companies are having and report that then to our LPs. So our LPs are a broad set of very sophisticated investors, very interested in finding platforms like ours that deliver both top-tier financial return and measurable social impact, which we then report to them on a quarterly basis. So this is very much integrated into the way that we do business, integrated into the way we make investment decisions, integrated into the way that we monitor and engage with our portfolio companies, and integrated into the way that we engage with our LPs as we keep them appraised of developments of the portfolio and you know how their investment in Kona is doing.
That's incredible. So could you share perhaps a success story from your portfolio that exemplifies this impact that Kona aims to achieve? And conversely, perhaps, are there any cases where Kona has passed on an investment that had a strong financial profile but didn't meet Kona's criteria for impact?
Sure. So many great examples. Let me choose one, which is from our first fund, an investment we made in Brazil in a company called Creditas, which is really bringing secured lending to the mass market, focused on home equity, auto finance, and payroll lending. And what makes Creditas unique and what attracted us to the whole story was, A, an understanding of the extraordinarily high cost of credit in Brazil. Unsecured consumer loans have interest rates of well over 100% per annum. Credit card interest rates are in the range of 400% per annum. And the availability of secured lending products in Brazil is very, very limited. Basically, you had home equity loans available for the very top end of the market through private banking relationships, very manual processes. But you had it's over 80% of Brazilians who own their homes outright with no mortgage, but no ability to be able to leverage that asset to be able to secure longer term, lower priced loans than what they would be able to otherwise get with the unsecured loans that were available in the market. And so Creditas, we backed 2015, just as they were getting started. We co-led the Series A. That company now is one of the market leaders in secured lending in Latin America, and certainly a market leader in Brazil, with a portfolio of well over $1 billion, hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of customers, and has really been able to make a significant difference in the lives of many families, and also of small businesses, because a lot of individuals are leveraging their asset to be able to invest into their businesses. But if you think then about how Creditas fits into our impact thesis, right? It's expanding access to these lending products to segments of the population that previously didn't have access to them by leveraging technology, process engineering, and a focus on being able to serve that mass market with products that they otherwise didn't have access to. Second, they're offering interest rates that are a fraction of what an unsecured consumer loan would be. And these are longer term loans than were previously available. And then third, Creditas has had a major impact on the markets because they've been able to demonstrate to the market in general that this segment can be served profitably, that these products can be brought to market at scale. What we've seen is a proliferation of players in home equity, in private payroll lending, and in auto equity to some extent, that in part have been inspired by what Creditas has been able to accomplish in the market. It's a huge market. There's plenty of room for multiple players, but we're proud of what Creditas has done to be able to demonstrate that this segment can be served very, very profitably and at scale by bringing a focus in technology.
Next, I'd like to focus on Kona's global outlook. You touched on how Kona has a team distributed around the world before next moving into your region of focus, which is Latin America. Can you tell us about Kona's investment theses across the regions where Kona invests, and how much overlap are there in the theses that Kona has in each of these markets?
Sure. So we invest across multiple fintech themes: payments, lending, banking, supply chain finance, insurtech. We're increasingly investing in embedded finance across sectors. These are embedded finance in SaaS platforms and the like that are serving particular segments, particularly in the B2B space. Cross-border payments and cross-border trade has become an increasing focus for us, both on the embedded finance space and in pure payments. And then we've also invested in enabling infrastructure that is necessary in order to be able to embed financial services into non-financial services. You need banking as a service, payments as a service, and other infrastructure that makes it possible to not have to build things from scratch, but to incorporate these services with low cost and low friction. So those are the sectors that we invest in, and we see a lot of commonality across our markets. Obviously, there are markets that are more mature than others. There are markets that, like Latin America, have been middle income for decades, and if I had a segment of the population that's always been very well served, has a good and solid infrastructure upon which financial technology has been able to build. There are other markets like Africa or even Southeast Asia, where those financial services have not been as prevalent, where the foundations haven't been as deep, and where the opportunity set then is perhaps a bit more focused on building leapfrogging infrastructure and services than what we'd see in Latin America. At the same time, there's a lot of commonality in themes, and there's a lot of learnings for entrepreneurs as they launch services from what has worked and what hasn't in other markets. And there are a lot of learnings also in seeing the evolution of the regulatory landscape across these various markets. There are different speeds of evolution, even within regions. And the ability of us to be able to leverage that understanding, leverage that knowledge to make investment decisions and bring value to our portfolio companies has proven invaluable. But the basic themes remain very similar. The ability to build and deliver services to these underserved segments has more commonality than differences.
Having a team distributed across the world seems like it would be a significant competitive advantage. Do you feel that Quona's global footprint allows you to develop better pattern recognition when creating investment theses or when identifying winning founders and startups?
Yes, we like to say that we're the most local of global firms and the most global of local firms. Our team, as you know, is widely distributed across the markets we invest in. We consider ourselves very much part of the local milieu in each of the markets that we invest in. So we have our team in Asia is based in Bangalore and Singapore, Latin America, Mexico City and Sao Paulo. In Africa, we have team members in Cape Town, Lagos, Nairobi, Dubai. Our back office operations is largely in the U.S. and two of the co-founders are based in the U.S. Otherwise, all of the investment team is in the markets we invest in. I do think that that gives us, an understanding of local markets, an understanding of how they fit into the global context, and allows us to have an approach to investments that is not rigidly tied to needing to make investments in a particular country and or region. We're able to build a portfolio of what we consider to be the very best of fintech opportunities across these various markets and take the experience and the perspective that we have about the regulatory market environment in each of these regions, in each of these countries, to have a good, robust discussion and debate as a partnership about where to invest. One of the cool things that we've been able to see over the last decade is the development of opportunities at different speeds across different markets. I referred to that a little bit earlier, but for example, challenger banking emerged first in Brazil, really at scale. We were able to leverage our experience investing in Neon, which is a challenger bank focused on lower income segments in Brazil. Today, serving many millions of customers, over $400 million of revenue that we invested in just as they were getting started. We've been able to leverage that learning to select what we consider to be the premier platform for challenger banking in Mexico, has brought experience to us that has been invaluable as we've made investment decisions about challenger banking in Indonesia. And in India, our experience with embedded finance, the first embedded finance investment that we made was in Brazil, in a company called Contabilize that incorporated financial services into a tax and accounting SaaS platform focused on freelancers. That experience we've been able to leverage as we've looked at opportunities elsewhere around the globe. And it's helped inform also our understanding and appreciation of the importance of banking as a service in order to allow companies like Contabilize to embed services, which has informed our investment decisions recently in companies like Shivalik in India, which is providing that banking as a service for embedded finance players in India. Same with small business services and banking, where we have investments in India, Indonesia, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, and I'm probably missing a couple, where the parallels and the opportunities for these companies initially generally focused on providing working capital loans, but then expanding to really provide a full suite of services for small businesses has had a lot more parallels than differences, but they've gone at different speeds. And again, that perspective based on our investments across multiple markets, multiple countries, multiple companies doing similar things, but at different speeds has proven to be very valuable to us as investors. And we think it's brought some unique value also to our portfolio companies. We believe this is a key differentiator. It allows us to complement our local and regional generalist VC peers, win a right at the table, and bring unique value to our portfolio companies and a portfolio construction that leverages this perspective and experience of this global team.
In an interview with Axios last August, Monica Brand-Engel, Quona's co-founder, mentioned that we'll see a lot of south-to-south M&A within fintech, by which I mean companies within Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, and Africa expanding into each other's markets. Can you talk about why this would be the case and how fintechs in emerging markets might be better suited for this kind of growth versus fintechs in more developed markets like the US or Europe?
Yeah, it stands to reason that that is going to increase and we're going to see more of that. I think having a commitment to emerging markets, an understanding of emerging markets makes it more natural as companies grow and scale, that they would look more favorably on growth and expansion into other markets through M&A. What we're seeing right now is quite a bit of M&A as larger platforms grow and scale and want to add products and services. So we've seen in Brazil, for example, companies like Nubank, Neon, Creditas making multiple acquisitions as they've expanded their service offerings. Creditas, for example, is able to launch its payroll lending through the acquisition of a smaller payroll lending company, was able to expand its offerings to include insurance by making an acquisition of an insurance player in Brazil. So we are starting to see some of that happen as some of these platforms grow and scale and want to expand what they're able to offer to their customers. We've also seen companies coming out of emerging markets expanding globally. Certainly the Chinese led the way with many companies that expanded from China into multiple markets. But we've now seen companies like dLocal expanding from Latin America into markets all around the globe, major player in Africa and other markets. Ebanks, similarly out of Brazil, expanding across multiple emerging markets with their payment services, a big play in Africa and the like. I think we're going to see players like that making acquisitions as they expand in these markets. We've not seen a lot of it yet, so I would say that that is a promise of things to come. But I do agree with Monica that we should be seeing more and more of that as these fintech companies that we've been backing and others have been backing over the last decade get to scale and look to expand beyond their home markets.
So in the same interview, Monica had also mentioned that Quona is super bullish on Brazil and Mexico, which is, I think, a great way to segue into your area of focus. Can you tell us what opportunities Quona is most excited about in Latin America's two largest markets? And in a global context, what makes Brazil and Mexico stand out?
Brazil is unique in that it is today the beneficiary of the most progressive central bank probably in the world. And that's created a lot of opportunity for financial technology companies, for those challenging the status quo and incumbents. It started a long time ago, but we're now seeing an acceleration of the pace of change that is quite remarkable. So Brazil was one of the first to really deregulate the payment space, create competition in a space that was previously controlled by two players, for example, in the merchant acquiring space. That duopoly was broken up and gave rise to companies like Stone. Pagamentos had a very successful IPO today worth multiple billions of dollars. Companies like PagSeguro and others But what they've done is gradually really open the space for new entrants in payments, in lending, in banking, and in various services in the market. They've been very open to banking as a service, payment as a service players as well, with a regulatory regime or a license regime that allows new players to start without a heavy regulatory burden. And then gradually as they grow and scale, they have more and more requirements imposed on them, which makes a lot of sense. But what it's allowed for is for the emergence of new players over the last decade and a half that's brought real competition to a market that previously had five banks controlling 90% of banking assets. They still control 80%, but the whole market has grown. But then what we've seen is the central bank really leaning into the next phase of the digitalization of financial services. They launched an instant payment service called Pix that has had remarkable take up in Brazil, modeled after the UPI system in India, taking a lot of learnings about what worked, what didn't work in India, and improving on those. The adoption has been absolutely remarkable, and now they're rolling out open finance and also a digital currency project called Drex, which is going to have a significant impact, particularly on programmable payments, the way that intrabank transactions and settlements are done. Basically, think of that as the tokenization of money, tokenization of assets in Brazil. But we've, again, seen the regulator really creating the conditions now for a lot of innovation, a lot of disruption, and for us as investors, a lot of opportunity. And we see that in the sophistication of the companies that have emerged in Brazil, the sophistication of the investment opportunities, and in the development of companies at massive scale, right? Today, the largest challenger bank in the world, Nubank, is from Brazil. We've been able to back other players in the market that have gotten to massive scale. And a lot of this is because of a very forward-leaning central bank, which I would also note, you know, very satisfying to us, given that we're focused on that intersection of financial technology and financial inclusion, has been to hear the central bank in Brazil really embracing this regulatory innovation with the purpose of promoting financial inclusion. So financial inclusion is very front and center as they've been pushing regulatory boundaries, pushing for the digitalization of financial services and the creation of space for new players. I think that the story in Mexico is a bit different. There, I think regulation has developed more in fits and starts, as opposed to Brazil, which really has a completely independent central bank with a team that has longevity no matter who is in power. Mexico has had a central bank with a lot of good intentions, but perhaps not the continuity that is required to be able to really push through a regulatory regime as comprehensive and as ambitious as that of Brazil. At the same time, they have been quite supportive of new entrants. And we've seen now an explosion of opportunity in the fintech space in Mexico, again, running at a bit different speed. Regulatory environment is a bit more complex and messy, but great companies have been able to find their way through that. But what makes us bullish about Brazil is are some very interesting tailwinds. The economy actually is doing very well, in part because of companies looking to diversify and reduce risk in their supply chain, pouring into Mexico, investing in manufacturing, logistics to benefit from what we know as nearshoring. Mexico has been a massive beneficiary of some of the trade frictions with China, some of the uncertainties in Asia generally. So we've seen a huge wave of investment in Mexico, which is having a significant impact on the economic growth and prospects for that country, and is driving a lot of opportunity. So as we look at the investments that we've made in Mexico over the last year, and we have some fantastic investments we've made previously, companies like Confio providing financial services to small and mid-sized businesses at massive scale, Clar, which is a leading challenger bank bringing financial services to the mass market. We also have more recently invested in companies that are providing services that are meeting the needs of this growing manufacturing, distribution, nearshoring economy. Companies that are providing services, for example, to small trucking companies, providing services to Mexican and U.S. companies on a platform that connects these small trucking companies to their clients, manages contract payments, advance payments, provides them with lending alternatives and the like. Other companies that are focused on recurring importers that are taking advantage of these trends to grow significantly in Mexico. So those are the reasons why we're quite bullish about both of these markets. We have been investing in Mexico and Brazil for many years. We've been bullish about these markets for the past decade, but we're really seeing some very, very positive tailwinds as we look to the future. I would mention also that both Brazil and Mexico and much of Latin America was out in front of much of the globe in tackling inflation, raised interest rates very sharply, very early. Now with inflation largely under control, we're now on the other side with interest rates starting to come down fairly significantly across both of these markets, which we believe also provides some interesting tailwinds for us as we look at these markets over the next few years.
It's very exciting. And one element of what you mentioned that I thought was super interesting is the role of regulation in Latin America. I think perhaps counterintuitively in Brazil, regulation has actually been a massive catalyst of increased innovation and competition. I mean, you mentioned Pix, for example, and since it was launched in 2020, transaction volume of digital payments has more than tripled, for example. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the regulatory landscapes within Latin America into the future. So, for example, Roberto Campos Neto, who is the head of the BCB, is leaving his post at the end of the year.
It'd be great to hear what impact you think changes like these will have, and more broadly, how you see regulation continuing to impact innovation and financial inclusion in Latin America going forward.
So Brazil Central Bank has been independent for many years. Roberto Campos Neto certainly has been a fantastic leader, visionary, and has executed some incredible regulatory advances that today truly are the envy of the world. So he'll be sorely missed. However, I think what gives us all a lot of confidence is the independence of the central bank. We trust that the next president of the central bank will be similarly committed to the regulatory agenda and to the impact that it's having on financial services in Brazil. But recall that most important in as we look at the central bank in Brazil as compared to other markets is the fact that there's relatively little turnover other than the political appointee, which is generally a multi-year appointment across administrations. Otherwise, there's been a lot of stability, and that gives a lot of confidence. So we don't expect to see any significant changes, although everyone is watching to see who it is that is named into this position once the president of the central bank departs. What we see in other markets is less continuity and less stability, right? And that's had an impact on the development of the regulatory landscape. It's not been as linear and as progressive as what we've seen in Brazil. Already talked about that a little bit in the Mexican context. I would say that there are markets where there's been a strong commitment and stability more than in other countries. Chile stands out as a country with a progressive and independent regulator. But what's been good is to see Brazil inspiring regulators in other markets, even if they don't have the full independence and or stability that the central bank in Brazil has. They've been an inspiration for central banks across the region. But I do want to state Brazil is a standout, and not just a standout in the region. It's a standout globally, and we hope that continues to be the case.
So this has been a really interesting conversation. Before we conclude, I'd like to end with a blitz question round where I'll ask you a series of questions in rapid succession. So the first question is, what's something that most people don't know about you?
So my parents were Protestant missionaries. They were opening churches in Central America and Spain. That's a little unusual. But I learned a lot from them about doing hard things out of deep conviction in hard places.
Wow. Who's a leader or entrepreneur that you deeply admire?
So I've always been attracted by leaders with multiple interests and achievements. So folks that have inspired me and whose biographies I absolutely love reading, folks like Winston Churchill, Teddy Roosevelt, each of which had achievements very early on that most people would count as a lifetime achievement. And they went on to do multiple things. I love the curiosity and the enthusiasm with which they embraced life. I also am attracted to a bit of the contrarians. I find someone like an Elon Musk absolutely fascinating, a difficult and complex person, but that clearly has had a massive impact on multiple industries. Again, any one of those companies would have been a lifetime achievement for most people. And I guess in all of these cases, Winston Churchill, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, folks like Elon Musk and others, I think as you really dig into their lives, these are, you know, deeply flawed individuals, but an enthusiasm for the big ideas enabled them to have accomplishments over multiple decades that are, for me, a really great inspiration.
On the topic of contrarians, what is something that you believe that most other people would not?
Yeah, so I'm religious. I believe in a higher calling and purpose, and I know that's something that, you know, many of my peers, many of my friends don't share. It's a significant part of the way that I view the world, the way that I understand our place as human beings in it, and that informs the way that I engage with family, work, friends, and the world in general.
Tell us about the most recent experience that changed a previously held belief or worldview.
Yeah, maybe I'll mention something related to our investments, right? So something that I respect greatly was Avi's decision to pull back from Brazil. So Avi is a buy now, pay later provider out of Colombia. We invested as they were beginning to look to expand outside of Colombia, expanded into Brazil. And last year, the team came to the board and said, you know what, it's going to take a lot of resources to make Brazil work. We believe the opportunity is much greater for us to focus on Colombia, where things are doing very, very well. And this is a market that both of the co-founders, Santiago and Daniel, had moved to. They spent a couple of years of their own lives really pouring into the opportunity in Brazil. And I guess what that decision has challenged is my conviction that the only way forward is to advance. I think they demonstrated that is a good sentiment, but sometimes you need to know when to fold and when to challenge that conviction and when to make tough decisions. I really respect that, but it certainly challenged my conviction that the only way to advance is to move forward and to burn the ships. And I really respect their decision, the way they managed the discussion with the board.
And this is the last question. Outside of work, what is most important to you?
Oh, family, adventure in general. I love to travel. I love to run, trail running in particular. And I love to explore new places, trail running. Recently, I've taken up motorcycle riding. So anything that gets the adrenaline up helps me stay engaged and tapped into my more curious self.
Amazing. Well, Jonathan, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Wesley. Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We hope you found this conversation as enlightening as I did.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Wharton FinTech Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please follow us on social media or leave us a review. We appreciate your support and hope that you'll continue to spread the word to more listeners. Until next time, this is your host, Wesley Astor.